Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The multi-front effort to sell the international agreement on Iran's nuclear program to U.S. lawmakers and skeptical allies continues Thursday, a day after U.S. President Barack Obama gave a staunch defense of the deal.
This nuclear deal meets the national security interests of the United States and our allies. It prevents the most serious threat, Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon, which would only make the other problems that Iran may cause even worse.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is out generating support among congressional Democrats about the agreement, but the administration faces stiffer opposition from Republican lawmakers. Once Congress has handed the formal agreement, it has 60 days to consider whether to reject it. And even if it does, Mr. Obama has promised to veto such legislation. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeatedly criticized the negotiations throughout the process. He is meeting Thursday with British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, one of the diplomats who negotiated with Iran to seal the historic agreement earlier this week. The Egyptian affiliate of the Islamic State says it has carried out a missile strike on an Egyptian Navy vessel off North Sinai, the site intelligence group said Thursday. Egyptian officials had said the Navy vessel had caught fire following a clash with militants and that there were no fatalities among its crew. Earlier this month, IS claimed responsibility for a massive terrorist attack on Egyptian army checkpoints on the Sinai Peninsula, killing at least 64 soldiers. You are listening to the news coming to you from the Voice of America. Greece won a financial lifeline Thursday from its European neighbors, with Eurozone finance chiefs agreeing to hand Athens a short-term loan to meet its immediate debts. The finance ministers in Europe's 19-nation euro currency bloc took the actions just hours after Greek lawmakers approved tough austerity reforms demanded by Athens' creditors. The pension cuts and tax increases were adopted after a contentious debate inside parliament and police clashes with anti-austerity protesters outside on the streets of Athens. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said the European Union will hand Greece the short-term loan that will allow it to make a $4.6 billion loan payment it owes the European Central Bank on Monday. A drone strike in southern Somalia has killed 30 members of the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab, including several top leaders, Kenyan officials said Thursday. The U.S. military has not commented on media reports that a U.S. drone carried out the attack late Wednesday near the town of Bader in the Gedo region. The slain al-Shabaab leaders included Jamadar and Ismail Jabhad, said Mwanda Njoka, spokesman for Kenya's Ministry of Interior and Coordination of National Government. Swiss authorities say they have extradited one of seven detained FIFA officials to the United States to face corruption charges. Switzerland's Federal Office of Justice did not identify the official from football's governing body, but said he was extradited Wednesday. He was one of seven people arrested in a dawn raid on a Zurich hotel May 27th. The men are accused by U.S. authorities of involvement in more than $150 million worth of bribes given for marketing deals for football tournaments in North and South America. Ukraine's parliament approved a draft law Thursday to grant greater autonomy to the separatist regions of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. As required by the ceasefire agreement reached last February in the Belarusian capital, Minsk, President Petro Poroshenko submitted the bill to parliament to give the regions that have proclaimed themselves people's republics some powers of self-rule. U.S. President Obama becomes the first sitting president to visit a federal prison as part of his push for fairer justice system and prison reform. Mr. Obama travels Thursday to El Reno Prison in the Midwestern state of Oklahoma, where he will meet separately with law enforcement officials and nonviolent drug offenders. In a speech earlier this week, Mr. Obama called for either reducing or eliminating mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug crimes. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
An agreement has been reached on a global financial structure to meet new United Nations development goals. But civil society organizations say it does not include a way to prevent corporate tax dodgers.
That's Martha van der Wolf reporting from Addis Ababa. Details coming up also in the news. A drone strike in southern Somalia has killed two military commanders of the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. And Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni left Burundi today without negotiating a deal between President Pierre Nkurunziza and political opponents. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Lesotho, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a drone strike in southern Somalia has killed two military commanders of the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. The attack occurred late yesterday near the town of Bardari in the Gedo region. A local journalist tells VOA the slain militant were Jama Diri, the deputy commander of Al-Shabaab fighters in the lower Juba region, and Ismail Jabad, a senior military officer for the group. Bardiri, about 400 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu, is a stronghold for Al-Shabaab. Somali government troops and Ethiopian forces are preparing for an assault to retake the town. Somali media are reporting it was a U.S. drone that carried out the attack, but there has been no confirmation from the U.S. military. The U.S. has used drone strikes to attack Al-Shabaab leaders in the past, including the group's supreme leader, Ahmed Abdi Godane, who was killed in a drone strike in September 2014. Al-Shabaab has been pushed out of most of the territory it once controlled across southern and central Somalia, but the group continues to launch suicide attacks in both Somalia and Kenya, including an assault at a Kenyan college in April that killed 148 people. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni left Burundi today without negotiating a deal between President Pierre Nkurunziza and political opponents who oppose his plans for re-election on July 21st. Burundi has been in political turmoil since Mr. Nkurunziza declared he would run for a controversial and some say unconstitutional third term. More than 100 people have died in clashes between police and demonstrators, and more than 150,000 have fled to neighboring countries. Mr. Museveni says he hopes opposition parties and civil society will engage with the ruling National Council for the Defense of Democracy to reach an agreement similar. Diplomatic efforts by the UN have failed. Meanwhile, Alexis Senduji, a leader of Burundi's Movement for Solidarity and Development in Exile, told Radio France International today that opponents of Mr. Nkurunziza have formed a National Transition Council to ensure that Mr. Nkurunziza is not elected to a third term. Mr. Museveni represented regional efforts to find a political solution. Some Western powers have withdrawn aid in an effort to curb Mr. Nkurunziza's political ambitions. An agreement has been reached on a global financial structure to meet new United Nations development goals, but civil society organizations say it does not include a way to prevent corporate tax dodgers. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
A four-day United Nations conference in Ethiopia reached an agreement on a financial framework for the Sustainable Development Goals, the successor of the Millennium Development Goals. But the new framework does not include a UN global tax body. Wu Hongbo is the UN Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs. He says the agreement will be a strong foundation for implementing sustainable goals. Hongbo says that the agreement at the moment is the best they could get despite it not including a global tax body.
I am aware there are quite a few reports about the discussions about the taxation issue. All the member states are fully aware the importance of taxation and the tax system. They all agree that international efforts should be strengthened in terms of taxation and related matters. I would also like to say, this is not the end of the journey. The member states will continue. This is a gradual process.
Taxation was a major part of discussions. Stronger taxation authority in developing countries could raise huge amounts of money and stop tax avoidance by international corporations. The European Union, United States, and other rich countries mostly opposed creation of a global tax body as part of the agreement. Alvin Mosioma is the executive director of Tax Justice Network Africa. He says there are a number of elements in the agreement that civil society organizations welcome, but that without a global tax authority, the deal is not as ambitious as hoped.
I think that developing countries were arm twisted by the rich countries to agree to a compromise document. I think that vested interest prevailed, the interest of the rich particularly.
The agreement reached in Ethiopia this week features a set of policy actions and initiatives. One is setting up a global infrastructure forum to identify infrastructure gaps. While the UN calls the deal historic and groundbreaking, some of the agreed upon points are very similar to those of 15 years ago. One of the outcomes is for countries to recommit to spend 0.7% on foreign aid. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Two rights groups say violence affects about 1 billion children every year, and its consequences cost economies $7 trillion annually. The NGOs say while violence against women and girls has gained more attention, violence against boys has not. It's a leading cause of death for adolescent boys in many parts of the world. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The groups Without Violence and Together for Girls say violence against children is a major challenge to development. They say that continued exposure to violence, whether as a victim or a witness, has significant detrimental effects on a child's brain. Those effects include post-traumatic stress, leading to social, emotional, and behavioral problems. Lisa Witter is executive director of Without Violence, or, as she describes herself, the group's chief optimist.
Violence against children is an issue that happens all around the world, in every country and every income level of a home, and whether the parents are educated or not, violence against children happens everywhere. We've learned in talking about the issue of violence that different people have definitions of what violence against children is. Is it mental abuse, physical abuse? Is it corporal punishment? Is it war? It's all of it. We're really looking at reducing violence in any setting and in any way against children.
Witter says girls are especially vulnerable to sexual violence and child marriage, which she also considers a form of violence.
Girls are much more likely to be married under the age of 18 than boys, and this is a real violent act. It's not under her own will, and they should be girls, not brides.
As for boys,
1 in 5 victims of homicide are children, and boys account for 70% of them. Real harsh violence is really a big issue for boys. Sexual violence, as I said, is a big issue for girls, but 73 million boys under the age of 18 experience sexual violence. So while girls are a higher risk factor for it, it's a boys' issue. And then the other issue we think a lot about are child soldiers. There are estimated 250,000 child soldiers in the world, and 90% of them are boys.
She also says that 156 million men alive today were married as children. Witter and Michelle Maloney Kitts, head of Together for Girls, have written an opinion piece in which they say violence is like a transmitted disease, and growing up around violence is the single best predictor that a child will go on to become either a victim or perpetrator of violence as an adult. They say that gender norms make it difficult for boys to admit they are victims of violence. In fact, on average, men who finally disclose they were sexually assaulted do so 22 years after the assault occurred. That's about 10 years later than women. To help boys become less vulnerable to violence, the NGOs recommend parenting programs for caregivers. School-based programs, they say, can teach adolescents about safe dating practices. And mentoring programs have shown success in preventing homicides or joining gangs. The groups want the issue included in the new UN Sustainable Development Goals that will be finalized in September. Witter says life can be better for every child if UN members invest in breaking the cycle of violence.
I care deeply about boys and girls, you know, and I want to reduce violence against girls, and I want to reduce violence against boys. I'm a mother of two young boys, 6 and 8, and this stuff is very personal to me. And we can't stop the cycle of violence unless we focus on boys and girls. And what we want to do is just continue through the UN process and through talking to companies and through talking to communities and help scaling things that we know that work really reduce violence.
In related news, at the third International Conference for Financing for Development in Addis Ababa this week, a global partnership was announced to end violence against children. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Sixteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Militants in the Sinai Peninsula have taken credit for firing a guided missile that today struck an Egyptian naval vessel in the Mediterranean about a mile offshore. Firefighters worked for more than 3 hours to put out the fire aboard the vessel. The militant group, now known as the Sinai Province of the Islamic State, claimed in a Twitter announcement that they destroyed the naval vessel and killed all on board. An Egyptian military spokesman, however, said on Facebook there were some injuries but no deaths aboard the damaged vessel. The blast occurred during an exchange of gunfire between the militants and the crew of the ship. The ship carries government troops and equipment from the Egyptian mainland to El Arish on the northeastern edge of the Sinai Peninsula. It was 2 years ago that the militants began attacking Egyptian military checkpoints on the peninsula. Nigeria produces vast amounts of oil, but the country has few functioning refineries, leaving Nigeria dependent on imports to fill up gas tanks across the country. VOA's Christine looks into why with Ibrahima Yakubu in Kaduna.
It is a paradox of Nigeria. The country produces more crude than anywhere else in Africa, but it depends on imported gasoline and diesel subsidized by the government to keep the lights on and cars running across the country. The new government of President Muhammadu Buhari has said it will get Nigeria's 4 refineries back up and running. But a spokesman for the Petroleum Marketers Union in the northern city of Kaduna, Alhaji Sani Selsabil, says his members have to drive hundreds of miles to find gasoline, even though they are based in the same city as one of the refineries.
Since the Kaduna refinery in particular is not functioning, we had to go down to the south, either Lagos, Port Harcourt, and what have you, to source for the fuel.
Nigeria's reliance on imported fuel leaves it vulnerable to supply disruptions, such as the one that happened in May, when a dispute between fuel importers and the government led to a nationwide shortage of gasoline. The government subsidy program, which keeps the price at the pump stable, has long been seen as riddled with graft. The managing director of the Kaduna refinery, Seydou Mohammed, says 2 other issues trouble the refinery: maintenance and insecurity. The refinery cannot run because the state oil company often has trouble affording repairs. When it can run, it finds its supply of oil from the southern city of Warri disrupted by pipeline thieves.
The moment we start pumping from Warri, they are waiting to start tapping.
Mohammed says the refinery is undergoing repairs, and once it gets enough oil, it will start processing again. But financial derivatives company CEO Bismarck Wawane says the problems with refineries show it may be time for government to get out of the business of processing.
Deregulate the industry and allow for new investment, privatize them, sell them as they are.
President Buhari is expected to eventually unveil proposed reforms to the oil sector. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Oil and gas revenues are still a major source of wealth for the Nigerian economy, but there are predictions that the country's recent production declines will continue because corruption and insecurity troubles have discouraged foreign investment. President Muhammadu Buhari has pledged to take action against corruption and insecurity issues. Matthew Juraki is the head of the Oil and Gas Research and Consultant for Global Data. He talks to VOA's David Arnold about the challenges Mr. Buhari faces in luring new investment to stop the decline.
Nigeria's production has fallen by over 15% since the beginning of the decade. So this amounts to over 400,000 barrels per day out of the 2.5 million barrels per day that they produced 5 years ago. So it isn't expected that the decline accelerates in the near term. It's becoming more likely that its neighboring country, Angola, surpasses Nigeria as the largest African producer, which is a significant milestone in itself and doesn't bode well for a reversal of that mature production profile going forward.
And why has this occurred?
The key reasons behind it include corruption in the industry, vandalism in terms of sabotaging infrastructure, siphoning off oil from and revenues from operators, and the various security issues within Nigeria. And more importantly, pending legislation that will ultimately impact oil and gas operations in Nigeria with the PIB. A bill which was introduced in Nigeria to reform the regulatory environment. So the PIB stands for Petroleum Industry Bill.
Does this relate to corruption, bribery?
It's supposed to create a more transparent regime. One of the key issues that he should tackle in trying to port the industry is specifically the corruption involved, and one of his first actions as president in terms of the oil and gas industry was to do just this, and he dissolved the board of the National Oil Company, NNPC, and that is seen as a positive move on his part in terms of tackling corruption.
You'd mentioned some security issues, not only Boko Haram, but the effort to bring peace to the production fields in the Niger Delta. There are two different conflicts going on here.
I mean, I think the general idea is that even resolution of these security issues, it's helpful, but the large oil operations are located offshore, so they're less affected by those threats. So the president can create the environment and conditions to encourage development. But again, it doesn't guarantee the reversal in the production decline. So in terms of what he can do is managing the corruption, finalizing the pending legislation regarding the fiscal terms so that there's no more uncertainty in terms of how profitable operations could be.
And some of the corruption issues are, I assume, not simply funds being siphoned off by government officials, but bribery by private companies.
Private companies operating in the country have operated within, you know, the local business practices as required to, you know, to maintain operations in the country. So with this shift, you know, the operators are going to have to adjust their business model.
Who are the investors that are going to be interested? And how long will it take to get this reinvestment?
Well, it's a challenge now because you have emerging basins and countries across Africa who are competing for the same capital. So if you look at Angola, where there's lots of opportunity in East Africa, for example, you're now looking at, you know, companies such as Chevron, Total, Exxon, Shell.
What are the countries that they're interested in?
If you look at the producing trends in Africa, the next large boom has been occurring in East Africa. But then if you look across West Africa, to the north and to the south of Nigeria and Angola, you have various exploration activities which have yielded significant discoveries or promise of resource that without the various issues that operators are facing in Nigeria.
Looking to the north and south, what countries are we talking about?
As far north as offshore Morocco and Western Sahara, there's been various exploration opportunities there, going down into Mauritania and Senegal and Gambia. If you go farther south into Gabon, Congo, there's also been several wells that have been drilled there, and then most recently in Namibia in the south and South Africa.
That was Matthew Juraki of Global Data talking to VOA's David Arnold about Nigeria's oil and gas production trends. A new report from conservation group Save the Elephants shows Hong Kong has more ivory products for sale than any other city in the world. As VOA's Gabe Joslow reports, the group says the illegal export of these products to mainland China is undermining government's efforts to stop the ivory trade.
According to the report released Thursday in Nairobi, researchers counted more than 30,000 ivory items on sale in Hong Kong in 72 different retail outlets. Most of the items are carved jewelry and figurines sold to tourists at luxury hotels and shops. In Hong Kong, the sale of ivory from registered stocks is permitted by law, but export to mainland China is not. Researchers found 90% of the ivory being sold in Hong Kong is being bought by customers from the mainland. Much of it is then smuggled illegally into China. Save the Elephants founder Ian Douglas Hamilton says the practice is damaging to China's efforts to stop demand for elephant ivory.
I think that the future of Africa's elephants actually lies in the hands of China. Hong Kong is part of China, and it's undermining the bans that are increasingly being deployed in China.
Douglas Hamilton says 100,000 elephants were killed across Africa for their ivory between 2010 and 2012. Most of the slaughter is driven by demand in Asia. Hong Kong has not legally imported ivory since 1990. New items are carved and sold from existing stocks. Although the report does not conclude that Hong Kong has been marketing illegal ivory, conservationists have suggested traders in the city may be slipping poached ivory into their stocks. Report lead researcher Esmond Martin says Hong Kong is a known transit point for illegal ivory and notes authorities there have seized several large shipments from Africa.
With these large consignments being intercepted in Hong Kong, almost all of them, according to the government and to the research that we've carried out, is going to mainland China, almost all of it. And this is an extremely important point. But the question to ask is how much is going through Hong Kong and it's not being picked up? And that is what we don't really know much about.
Martin says some of the larger shipments recently seized in Hong Kong originated from Kenya, Tanzania, and Togo. He says corruption along the supply line, starting in the national parks where elephants live, remains one of the most pressing challenges to stopping the ivory trade. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bendy.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A drone strike in southern Somalia has killed two military commanders of the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. And Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni left Burundi today without negotiating a deal between President Pierre Nkurunziza and political opponents. Coming up, music from Lesotho and in our feature segment, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari making fighting corruption a cornerstone of his agenda. I'm Yehius Wuhib and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with football for your sports report this evening.
Yehias joining us now with an update on the Gold Cup football tournament here in the United States is VOA's Tadi Abeje. Sporty greetings, Tadi.
Sporty greetings, Sunny. The field for the quarterfinals of the Gold Cup is set. The defending champion, USA, will host Cuba Saturday in Baltimore, Maryland. The Americans have an 8-match winning streak against the Cubans. This will be the fifth time these teams will play each other in the Gold Cup, with the U.S. winning all four previous matches. The United States finished atop Group A, beating Honduras and Haiti and drawing with Panama for a total of 7 points. Cuba finished in third place in Group C, with 1 win and 2 losses and 3 points. Ahead of Saturday's quarterfinal, U.S. head coach Jurgen Klinsmann made 3 changes to his team, which is allowed in the Gold Cup. Midfielder DeMarcus Beasley, midfielder Joe Corona, and forward Alan Gordon have been added to the roster to replace Gray Garza, Alfredo Morales, and Jozy Altidore. In Saturday's other quarterfinal in Baltimore, Haiti will play Jamaica. On Sunday, there will be 2 more quarterfinal matches just outside New York City. Trinidad and Tobago will take on Panama, and Costa Rica will play Mexico, which has won the most titles in Gold Cup history with 6. The Mexicans feature forward Oribe Peralta, who is the joint leading Gold Cup scorer with American Clint Dempsey. Each player scored 3 goals during group play. The Gold Cup semifinals will take place on July 22nd in Atlanta, Georgia. And the final will be played July 26th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm VOA's Tadi Abeje. Back to you, Sonny.
Thank you, Tadi. Our African football guru, David Legg, has been looking at recent club action on the continent. This evening, David's focus is the CAF Confederation Cup tournament, and he begins with a draw in Mali's capital.
Group A in Bamako, which was Stade Malien of Mali 0, Al Ahly of Egypt, the holders, 0. And in Rads in Tunisia, it was Esperance of Tunisia 0, Etoile Sahel of Tunisia 1. Only 1 goal in those 2 Group A matches, Sunny. And in fact, when I look at the log, only 5 goals from 4 games. That's an average of 1.25 goals a game. Not particularly exciting. Al Ahly were always going to have problems in Mali because they were short 7 of their players, and that was because of suspensions, injuries, and imminent military call-ups. And at the end of it, Fati Mabrouk, their coach, said he was satisfied with a point. An additional problem, Sunny, for the Al Ahly team was that the match was played on a scorching afternoon in Bamako, and at the moment, because of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, the Egyptian players are all fasting, so that was an additional problem. All in all, I think Ahly probably reasonably satisfied, Sonny, with that 0-0 draw. On the other hand, Etoile Sahel, they did well to win 1-0 away to Esperance because they had a player sent off after 30 minutes. But despite being a man down, Jamal scored after 50 minutes to give Etoile Sahel victory. Etoile Sahel, we mention this regularly on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
A very interesting club in that they are the only one who have won every CAF club competition. They won the Champions League, the Confederation Cup, They've won two competitions that are now defunct, the African Cup Winners' Cup and the old CAF Cup. Those two were replaced by the Confederation Cup. And they've also won the CAF Super Cup, so they've got a special place in the history of African club football. But in recent years, they have struggled. The last 2 years in the CAF Confederation Cup, they have failed to get out of the group stage, despite being fancied on both occasions to do so. But they're now doing well, Sonny. If I look at the standings, it's all Sahel, 2 matches, 6 points, maximum points. Athlete, 2 matches, 4 points. Stade Malien, 2 matches, 1 point. And Esperance, surprisingly, one of the top clubs in Africa, bottom of the table, 2 matches, no points. And in the next round of fixtures, we don't have the precise dates yet, but they will be played between July 24 and 26. Athlete are at home to Etoile, and it's a top-of-the-table clash. And then you've got Esperance at home to Malien. And I suppose, Sonny, that one is really win or bust for both clubs, because Malien are already 5 points behind Etoile and Esperance 6. So another defeat for either of those clubs. And I think that's it as far as their chances of qualifying for the semi-finals. If we move on to Group B, the top of the table clash was in Nelspruit, a northeastern city in South Africa. And that finished Orlando Pirates of South Africa 1, Zamalek of Egypt 2. And in Sfax, way up in the east coast of Tunisia on the Mediterranean, it was CS Sfaxien of Tunisia 1, Leopards of Congo Brazzaville 1. Now, the top of the table clash was really fascinating. A lot of good football. And at the end of the day, Zamalek, Sonny, to me, stood out as a club that can go all the way and win this Confederation Cup. That is how impressed I was by them. They certainly didn't have the better of the first half. In fact, Pirates would not have been flattered to lead at halftime, but there were no goals. The old South African problem, the lack of clinical finishing. Several chances, but they were not put away. And ironically, it was when Pirates went ahead after 68 minutes to substitute Majoro that Zamalek really came to life. They suddenly switched from second gear to overdrive. Youssef, a Nigerian, equalized within 4 minutes, and Fati scored a sublime winner 6 minutes from the end. Sonny, this was one of the goals I've seen in the Confederation Cup this year. He managed to squeeze the ball past several defenders, curl it across the goalkeeper, Mokwongo, and into the far corner of the net. Absolutely exquisite goal. So well done to Zamalek. They looked impressive. This is a side that came to South Africa 2 years ago. It took a 4-1 beating from Pirates, but they've clearly improved a lot. In the other match, a bit of a surprise, really. One with a fancy Sfaxien at home against Leopards. Leopards had lost in the first round at home to Pirates. But it was the Congolese who went ahead through Ganze 4 minutes before halftime. Malul, as he often did, scored for Sfaxien, converting a penalty 4 minutes after halftime for an equaliser. In the standings, Zamalek, 2 games, maximum 6 points. Pirates, 2 games, 3 points. And then Leopards and Sfaxien, 2 games each and 1 point each. The next fixture, Sonny, July 24, 25 or 26, Sfaxien at home to Pirates and Zamalek at home to Leopards. I've got no hesitation in tipping Zamalek to beat Leopards in Egypt. I believe it's not a question of who will win, but by how much. But the other game is crucial, perhaps even more for Sfaxien than for Pirates. Sfaxien, remember, have won the Confederation Cup a record 3 times, and they've been runners-up once, so they're the giants of this competition. But I believe, Sonny, if they don't get maximum points at home to Pirates, they're as good as dead in this group. And as with the Champions League, it's the group winners and the group runners-up after 6 rounds of match play that qualify for the semi-finals.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. The 144th British Open Golf Tournament officially teed off Thursday. VOA's Jonah Haskell has this update for us. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sonny. The Open, better known as the British Open, began Thursday in picturesque St. Andrews, Scotland, widely known as the home of golf. This year, players are teeing off on the Old Course, one of the oldest courses in the world, known for its lack of trees and firm fairways that make it the quintessential links golf course. American Dustin Johnson leads the field at 7-under after shooting an opening round 65. Johnson also led after the opening round of the U.S. Open in June. He had a chance to win that tournament on the final hole of the final round, but three-putted to give the win to Jordan Spieth instead. Spieth, who is from Texas, also won the Masters in April and is chasing history as he looks to become the first player to win all four majors in a year since Bobby Jones in 1930. He started off well, birdieing five of his first seven holes, and sits just two strokes behind Johnson at 5-under. Before teeing off, Jordan spoke about what it would be like to win in Scotland.
It'd be something I'd never forget. I've watched the Open Championships here at St. Andrews, and I don't think there's anything more special in golf than playing an Open Championship at the home of golf. I have fond memories from playing here a few years back, vivid memories. One of those courses you play where you don't really forget much. Here and at Augusta National are my two favorite places in the world, and our preparation's almost complete, and I feel really good about last week heading into here, and all in all, I'm extremely excited. It would mean the world to me to try and win this championship, and to do it here would be even more special.
Special indeed. South African golfers Retief Goosen and Louis Oosthuizen both had stellar first rounds, as Goosen finished one shot off the lead at 6-under, while Oosthuizen, who won the Open on this course in 2010, sits at 5-under. Goosen was thrilled by his performance and hopes to be in contention on Sunday.
Definitely one of the best rounds I've played around here at St. Andrews. It's a long way to go. Mentally wise, you need to be very strong. And we'll just, take it one day at a time, see what the weather is going to do. Scoring is good, so there's a lot of players in with a chance, I think, come Saturday, Sunday. The last two Opens that were here, I think I finished fifth and sixth or something, so I do like the course. And so, yeah, I would like to be there come Sunday and maybe I have a chance. Who knows? It will be great.
Goosen, who has won the U.S. Open twice, has never finished above fifth place at St. Andrews. Tiger Woods, a two-time Open champion himself, continued his run of bad form at majors as he had trouble with the distance of his shots all day long and finished with a 4-over 76. Scores will most likely be inflated in the second round Friday, as rainy and windy conditions are expected to make things tough for all players, although Tiger is hoping that he will be able to play well through the weather and shorten the sizable gap between himself and the leaders. One notable absence at the Open is that of defending champion and world number one Rory McIlroy. The 26-year-old North Irishman is sitting out this year due to a serious ankle injury that he sustained a few weeks ago while playing football with friends. There is no clear timetable for his return, although some analysts believe that it might not be until January. With your Thursday British Open update, I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thank you, Jonah, and thank you to Tati Abeje. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Sending it back to Yehaeus Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and thanks, of course, to Tati Abeje and Jonas Haskell. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sun has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari making fighting corruption a cornerstone of his agenda. And next, protest march off streets of street vendors in Zimbabwe. But first, some music. Here is L.A. Forbes from Lesotho with Spiral Aloe.
Vale kibimba nanda bisakiri kumbutu minderi bada sukiri kulondi kiamfu kibwidi vale kibiesi bisukiri
hey amenda mambu kane hey amenda biesi bisukiri mama bonga
mari yaya mari wangazi uite yala batafera manguri mpindi kama ngwana ululonga na kaba waki uite yanga mpinga We go and get people, 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 we go and get people,
Leigh Forbes from Lesotho with Spiral Aloe. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has made fighting corruption a cornerstone of his agenda. As Chris Stein reports for VOA, one way the president plans to do that is by tracking down money stolen from the country's coffers.
For years, Nigerians have pledged to get money back from their predecessors. Former President Goodluck Jonathan's administration, for instance, secured a deal to recover money from late dictator Sani Abacha. And now President Muhammadu Buhari's government is saying he has won support from the United States and European governments to find more money spirited away from Nigeria. President Buhari has not been specific about which administrations he plans to probe. But he won office partially on the votes of people concerned about corruption under the administration of Mr. Jonathan. While Mr. Buhari said in his inaugural address that he was not looking to settle scores, analysts say Mr. Jonathan's administration will be a likely target for any probe. Policy and Legal Advocacy Center Executive Director Clement Nwankwo.
Certainly we hope that he doesn't go into persecuting people, but certainly some of this corruption is so fresh and so deep, don't think that he can avoid it.
Corruption has long been cited as one of the reasons why millions of Nigerians remain impoverished, despite the country producing more oil than anywhere else in Africa. But even high-profile efforts to win back money, like the recovery of $380 million allegedly stolen by Mr. Abacha announced earlier this year, have not necessarily benefited Nigerians, says Adayat Hassan, executive director of the Center for Democracy and Development.
The Abacha loot was recovered. Lots of loot were recovered. But what in actual fact were those funds used for? That will also be the next step Nigeria will have to focus on.
President Buhari's administration could use all the money it can get. The president recently described the treasury as virtually empty. This week, the government said it would tap into a special account for excess money made from oil sales to pay down the country's debts. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
In Zimbabwe, hundreds of street vendors recently marched in the capital, Harare. Police tried to block their march, but the street merchants wanted to petition Parliament over a government plan to relocate them to designated vending sites. Thomas Chipasi of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Harare.
More than 300 placard-carrying street vendors gathered along Resende Street near town now, demanding that the government should extend its June 26 deadline to relocate them to designated vending sites, arguing that the government's plan is not feasible. Heavily armed police details formed a human shield, blocking the protesters from proceeding to Parliament, where they intended to hand over their petition. After more than an hour of negotiations between police and the leaders of the protest, the two groups agreed to allow only four vendors to proceed to the August House to submit their petition. One of the leaders of the demonstrators, Justice Munyai, board secretary of the National Vendors Union of Zimbabwe, or NAVUZ, told the demonstrators that vending was the only source of their livelihood and vowed not to relocate to any other sites that are being proposed by government, saying they were not enough to accommodate all the vendors.
This eviction, what it means literally is that we are going to die, because evicting us from the streets means our livelihoods would have stopped. From that moment, our livelihoods emanate from the day-to-day sales we make in the streets, and my living is not lucrative. I live from hand to mouth. So if for only 24 hours I'm stopped from operating in the CBD, it means that I will not be able to provide for my family.
Munai added that the vending sites that have been designated by government were being run by what he called space barons that he claims are politically connected. The NAVUZ leader said authorities should address the economic challenges facing the country that are forcing many people to turn to informal trading.
The petition is imploring the government to come to terms with the fact that our economy is ailing. And since our economy is ailing, removing the symptoms of this ailing economy will not solve the problem.
Movement for Democratic Change Member of Parliament for Bulawayo East, Tabitha Kumalo, who joined the demonstrators,
said the ZANU-PF government should deliver on its election promises if it were to address the unemployment crisis that is resulting in many Zimbabweans turning into vending in order to eke out a living.
What we are saying as Zimbabweans, the ZANU-PF government promised 2.2 million jobs to the Zimbabwean people. And those jobs are not there. If they want these vendors off the streets, bring the 2.2 million jobs.
The protesters then agreed to disperse after learning that their petition had been delivered at parliament. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Burundi's controversial presidential election has been postponed until July 21st amid escalating violence there. Soldiers and unidentified gunmen clashed recently in Kayanza province near the border with Rwanda. The governor there said the gunmen had crossed from Rwanda, a charge denied by Rwandan leaders, but which could fan fears that the political infighting and street protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza's running for re-election could escalate into a wider conflict. Burundi's opposition is boycotting the election, saying that Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term is unconstitutional. The announcement of his re-election bid in April triggered weeks of demonstrations, some deadly. The president cites a court ruling saying he can run again. Presidential spokesman Gervais Abayeho said Nkurunziza signed a decree postponing the voting, once scheduled for July 15th, in response to a request from the leaders of the East African Community partner states. The African nations had sought a delay until July 30th to give Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni time to try to mediate a dialogue between President Nkurunziza and the opposing groups, in an effort to restore peace and security. Abayeho said such a delay would be beyond constitutional limits. The United States is deeply concerned by reports that fighting has broken out in several areas of Burundi and by recently broadcast remarks by Burundians threatening to use force against their government. We urge all parties there to commit themselves to constructive dialogue to resolve peacefully the political impasse that threatens to unravel the peace and stability ushered in by the implementation of the Arusha Agreement over a decade ago. The United States condemns violence as a means to attain political goals and opposes any attempt to seize power through extra-constitutional means. We strongly oppose any armed activity or incursions into Burundi and will seek to hold accountable those responsible for gross human rights abuses.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I judge. This one I judge.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.